Howe wasn't coming, or at least he wasn't following Burgoyne's game plan, and the British lost the Battle of Bennington, which prevented them from gathering the supplies they needed to advance and oppose the rebels.
At this point, Burgoyne had only 30 days worth of supplies to push through a growing rebel army or turn back. He still had some serious artillery and one of the most disciplined armies in the world. As far as Burgoyne was concerned, all of the advantages belonged to him. Well, all except one.
What is that, Grandpa?
The rebels got to choose the ground where the battle was fought and had time to entrench their position on the Hudson River.
You mean Stillwater?
Right. General Gates and a Polish engineer named Thaddeus Kosciuszko knew that Burgoyne was coming down the west side of the river, bound for Albany, and had prepared a defensive position. Plus, by September 1st, Arnold had returned from his victory over St. Ledger at Fort Stanwix, adding reinforcements to Gates' force.
So Arnold is back, but what was so special at Stillwater?
Why, the geography, of course. Between Saratoga and Stillwater, there is an 11-mile stretch of navigable waterway. If you look downriver, you will see that both sides of the river are covered in mountains and high bluffs, which made land travel difficult. The area that the rebels entrenched is called Bemis Heights, named for a local farmer and tavern owner named Jonathan Bemis. It was situated on a bluff that stood on the only road to Albany on this side of the Hudson.
So it is like everybody is funneled into this place.
Exactly. So around Bemis Heights was a river, ravines, and ridges, and forests that all worked together to create a natural funnel, limiting movement to the east and west. To make things more difficult for Burgoyne's advance, the rebels constructed fortifications and dug foxholes and trenches that they barricaded by felled trees.
So is there an open field for battle like the Brits are used to?
Open, yes. Clear, no.
What do you mean?
Well, you remember when your dad had that tree removed from the backyard last year?
Yes, what about it?
Well, if you remember, your dad and I cut down the tree pretty quickly. But getting that tree stump out of the ground was a major pain. Can you imagine having to do that without a truck and chains?
I bet it would take some serious effort.
Rather than remove the tree stumps, the farmers in these parts just plowed around them. They became serious obstacles. Burgoyne's men were not able to advance in their neat columns, nor could they load and fire by the line. They had some preparation for this, but it gave an advantage to the rebels, who used the landscape to their advantage. Wasmes noted this at Bennington.
We have seen today how the enemy attacks. Either lying on the ground or standing behind trees, they load their guns and shoot. They run from one tree to another and then forward as circumstances demand. And the savages do likewise.
This was no gentleman's war.
Nope. About 1 week after leaving Fort Miller, Digby described Burgoyne's effort to probe the enemy forces and harass their front lines.
September 16th. We heard General Gates had been there the preceding day attended by a corps of riflemen. A detachment with about 2,000 men with pieces of cannon attended General Burgoyne on a reconnoitering party toward the enemy. We remained out till near night and fired our evening gun at sunset to make them imagine we had taken post near them, but afterwards returned to our camp with the gun.
What did he mean about a corps of riflemen?
The British were used to a musket called the Brown Bess, which was pretty inaccurate. The long rifle was more of a phenomenon of the American frontiersmen, and it was much more precise.
Cool, so Gates had sharpshooters.
Remember, these Americans were living in a frontier wilderness, and the Americans had to stay in a constant state of readiness to protect their family from bears and wolves. Most Americans had guns and were expected to muster in the event of enemy attack.
But why didn't Burgoyne have any riflemen?
Relatively few had a rifle, which probably would have cost a year's earning for an average person. Another disadvantage of the rifle is that you could not affix a bayonet, so they were less effective in close range or hand-to-hand combat. The British, in particular, needed a standardized weapon so that they didn't have to stock parts and ammunition for various sized guns.
That makes sense.
Daniel Morgan and his regiment of Virginia Riflemen, known as Morgan's Riflemen, were sent to join General Gates to help establish better conditions for the battle. They were sniping from foxholes or behind trees at the Brits, Indians, and scouts, which prevented Burgoyne from getting intel on the rebel position.
This was definitely not a gentleman's war. So that is why he had to send 2,000 men. What did you call that?
A probe. Obviously, scouts cannot be very effective when being picked off by riflemen. Time was short, and Burgoyne needed to get to Albany.
It was then pretty certain and generally believed, and indeed wished, for that we should shortly have a decisive engagement. I say wished for, as they would never allow us to go into winter quarters till we had gained some great advantage over them. Should that be the case, many of the country would join us.
We just passed through Schuylerville on our way to Stillwater in the battlefield. We're going to come back here later. What we're going to do is go to the scene of the showdown between British General John Burgoyne and Continental General Horatio Gates, which occurred on September 19 at Freeman's Farm.
So did Burgoyne break his army into three columns again like he did in Ticonderoga?
He did indeed. If you look at the map, one column of British troops would move west about 2 miles inland. A second column of British troops moved about a mile inland, and the third column, made of German troops, moved along the river road and defended the supplies.
They're all moving south to attack the entrenched rebels. Pincer left, center, right.
At daybreak, intelligence was received that Colonel Morgan, with the advance party of the enemy, consisting of a corps of riflemen, was strong about 3 miles from us. Their main body, amounting to great numbers, encamped on a very strong post about a half a mile in their rear. And about 9 o'clock, we began our march. Every man prepared with 60 rounds of cartridges and ready for instant action. We moved in three columns, ours to the right, on the heights and farthest from the river in thick woods.
Arnold commanded the American left, which is the western edge of the battlefield. He realized a flanking maneuver on his position was likely and petitioned Gates for permission to move his forces from the heights to meet the Brits' potential movements. If the Brits succeeded in getting around the western edge of the rebel fortifications, then the rebel entrenchments would be compromised. Gates, whose preferred strategy was to sit and wait for the expected frontal assault, grudgingly permitted a reconnaissance in force.
So Morgan and Arnold have moved to the woods to the west to prevent the Brits from getting around their position. It sounds like there are some bad feelings between Gates and Arnold.
Yes, but this is the start of a battle. About noon, scouts from the center column encountered Morgan's riflemen at the farm of John Freeman, a loyalist who had fled to Burgoyne's camp.
A little after 12, our advanced piquets came up with Colonel Morgan and engaged. But from the great superiority of fire received from him, his numbers being much greater, they were obliged to fall back, every officer being either killed or wounded except one, when the line came up to their support and obliged Morgan in his turn to retreat with loss.
For most of the afternoon, a furious struggle raged on. Arnold committed additional regiments until the nervous Gates cut off the action, leaving the battered British in possession of the ground.
About 1:30, the fire seemed to have slacked a little, but it was only to come on with double force. From the situation of the ground, and their being perfectly acquainted with it, the whole of our troops could not be brought to engage together, which was a very material disadvantage, though everything possible was tried to remedy that inconvenience, but to no effect.
So it went back and forth, but eventually Burgoyne turned back the rebels.
Not so fast, Marshal. Morgan may have turned back, but they merely returned to their entrenched position.
I don't get why the rebels are on the defensive.
Gates believed that the best offense was a good defense. The British held the field, but had failed to unseat the rebels from their entrenched position. At the end of the day, there was devastation everywhere.
During the night, we remained in our ranks, and though we heard the groans of our wounded and dying at a small distance, yet could not assist them till morning. Not knowing the position of the enemy and expecting the action would be renewed at daybreak, sleep was a stranger to us. But we were all in good spirits and ready to obey with cheerfulness any orders the general might issue before morning dawn.
What about Burgoyne? How did he do in the battle?
Digby praised Burgoyne's actions.
General Burgoyne was everywhere and did everything that could be expected from a brave officer. And Brigadier General Fraser gained great honor by exposing himself to every danger.
Wait a minute. So Fraser and Burgoyne were at risk of being shot? I thought it was frowned upon to shoot at an officer.
Morgan and his riflemen did not fight a traditional gentleman's war. One rebel newspaper wrote,
"During the action, a party of our men got up into some trees, and as the clouds of smoke opened, poured in upon the enemy single shot. In this manner, several of the officers were killed or wounded, and it is said that Burgoyne had a narrow escape."
Their uniforms gave away their rank, and it didn't help that many of the officers were on horseback. The Baroness was in a little house where she was a witness to the whole affair.
Whoa, I wouldn't expect her to be so close to the action.
Here was her account.
On the 19th of September, there was an affair between the two armies, which it is true ended to our advantage. Although we were nevertheless obliged to make a halt at a place called Freeman's Farm. I was an eyewitness to the whole affair, and as I knew that my husband was in the midst of it, I was full of care and anguish, and shivered at every shot, for I could hear everything. I saw a great number of wounded, and what was still more harrowing, they even brought three of them into the house where I was.
So from her perspective, Burgoyne won, but it seems to me that Arnold really carried the day by making sure the British couldn't get around them from the west. How did Gates feel about that?
Here is an account from an American officer.
Gates seemed to be piqued that Arnold's division had the honor of beating the enemy on the 19th. This I am certain of. Arnold has all the credit of the action. And this I further know, that Gates asked where the troops were going. And upon being told, he declared no more troops should go. He would not suffer the camp to be exposed. Had Gates complied with Arnold's repeated desires, he would have obtained a general and complete victory over the enemy. But it is evident to me he never intended to fight Burgoyne until Arnold urged, begged, and entreated him to do it.
How come Arnold and Gates were against each other?
Well, you have to remember that Gates replaced Schuyler. Arnold and his officers were Schuyler's friend, and that created animosity from the outset. Tensions came to a peak on September 22nd. Arnold had learned that he wasn't even listed as the commanding general of his division in the report to Congress. Here's Arnold.
When I mentioned these matters to you this day, you were pleased to say, in contradiction to your repeated orders, that you did not know that I was Major General or had any command in the army.
Ouch! Sounds like a battle of egos.
I have been received with the greatest coolness at headquarters and often treated in such a manner as must mortify a person with less pride than I have and in my station in the army. I wish to be where I can be of the most service to them. I therefore request your pass to Philadelphia with my aide-de-camp and three servants, where I propose to join General Washington and may possibly have it in my power to serve my country, though I am thought of no consequence in this department.
You mean he wanted to leave?
Yes, but the men loved him and petitioned him to stay. It appears that the soldiers appreciated an officer like Arnold who led from the front. Here's an account from another American officer.
General Arnold's intention to quit this department is made public and has caused great uneasiness among the soldiers. To induce him to stay, General Poor proposed an address from the general officers and colonels of his division, returning him thanks for his past services and particularly for his conduct during the late action and requesting him to stay.
Okay, Grandpa, I kind of hate to ask, but what happened with Howe? Did Burgoyne ever hear from him?
Burgoyne was prepared to attack again the day after the battle, but he received a dispatch from General Henry Clinton, who Howe had left behind with 4,000 soldiers to guard home base at New York City while he went to Philly. Clinton informed Burgoyne that he was going to make a push on the lower Hudson Valley to help relieve him. Here is what Clinton wrote to Burgoyne.
Dear sir, you know my goodwill and are not ignorant of my poverty of troops. If you think 2,000 men can assist you effectively, I will make a push at Fort Montgomery, just south of West Point, in about 10 days. But ever jealous of my flanks, if they make a move in force on either of them, I must return to save this important post. I expect reinforcements every day. Let me know what you wish.
Burgoyne saw this as a way to divert the attention of the rebels. He and his men hunkered down for several weeks while he waited to hear from Clinton. The autumn air was getting crisper. It was beginning to bite.
The army were engaged daily in small skirmishes, but all of them of little consequence. My poor husband, however, during the whole time could not get a chance either to go to bed or undress. As the season had now become more inclement, a Colonel Williams of the artillery, observing that our mutual visits were very fatiguing, offered to have a house built for me with a chimney. I took him up, and the house, which was 20 feet square and had a good fireplace, was begun. They called it the blockhouse.
How could he afford to delay his advance to Albany? This is the end of the fighting season. They've cut their supply line. It's getting cold. Winter's in far. This is kind of a mess, isn't it?
He only had provisions through the 20th of October, and the men were put on half rations on October 3rd.
Did the hungry soldiers start to desert?
Yes. After the first battle here in Stillwater, desertion became a serious problem. As time went on, Burgoyne heard nothing from Clinton, and it became clear to him that he was not coming to help. Burgoyne refused to consider retreat, insisting that it would be disgraceful. But they were running short on food, manpower, and time. They needed to get to Albany. On October 7, about 1,700 combined British and German troops set out in a reconnaissance in force. He aimed to probe the position and strength of the rebels.
Suddenly, however, on the 7th of October, my husband, with the whole general staff, decamped. Our misfortunes may be said to date from this moment. I had just sat down with my husband at his quarters to breakfast. I observed considerable movement among the troops. My husband thereupon informed me that there was to be a reconnaissance. On my way homeward, I met many savages in their war dress, armed with guns. To my question where they were going, they cried out to me, "War! War!" which meant they were going to fight. This completely overwhelmed me, and I had scarcely got back to my quarters when I heard skirmishing and firing, which by degrees became constantly heavier, until finally the noises became frightful.
A second battle.
It started when the half-starved troops happened upon a wheat field and stopped to harvest the wheat. The rebels saw them. Here's a report.
I perceived, about half a mile from the line of our encampment, several columns of the enemy, 60 or 70 rods from me, entering a wheat field which had not been cut and was separated from me by a small stream. And without my glass, I could distinctly mark their every movement.
After seeing Burgoyne's troops gather there, Gates ordered his men to attack. They forced them to abandon the wheat they had harvested as well as the cannon they brought with them.
Now Gates went on the offensive.
Yes, but he was still quibbling with Arnold. A Lieutenant Colonel John Brooks was there at the table with Arnold and Gates when the fighting began.
I was among the company and well remember that one of the dishes was an ox's heart. Well, at table, we heard a firing from the advanced picket. The armies were about 2 miles from each other. The firing increasing, we all rose from the table. And General Arnold, addressing General Gates, said, "Shall I go and see what is the matter?" General Gates made no reply, but upon being pressed, said, "I'm afraid to trust you, Arnold." To which Arnold answered, "Pray let me go. I will be careful, and if our advance does need support, I will promise not to commit you." Gates then told him he might go and see what the firing meant.
So what did the firing mean? That the fighting was becoming more intense?
Yes, and it was also getting more intense between Gates and Arnold. Generals Lincoln and Arnold immediately left the encampment and proceeded to the enemy lines. The rebel army had grown now to 13,000 men, almost double the size of Burgoyne's force. They were able to push the British back. As they withdrew, General Simon Fraser was mortally wounded by Morgan's riflemen.
That must have been a blow for Burgoyne.
Things continued to go downhill as the rebels overtook the Bremen Redoubt.
What's a redoubt?
It's like an entrenchment. This British entrenchment was defended by less than 200 Germans. Here is another American report.
"We were met by fire from the British infantry, which proved very fatal to one of our companies. They advanced with a quick step, firing as they came on. In short time, they ceased firing and advanced upon us. At this juncture, Arnold came up with a regiment and gave them a most deadly fire, which soon caused them to face about and retreat with a quicker step than they advanced."
As some of the American troops began to circle around the left side of the Bremen Redoubt, Arnold arrived on the scene. He rallied the men to advance on the German lines.
"The firing had now principally ceased on our left, but was brisk in front and on the right. At this moment, Arnold says,
'Well then, let us attack the Hessian lines.'
And the colonel replied, 'With all my heart.'"
Once again, Arnold was out front.
Yeah, a little too close to the front.
"No fire was received except from the cannon until we got within about 8 rods, when we received a tremendous fire from the whole line. But a few of our men, however, fell. Still advancing, we received a second fire, in which a few of our men fell, and General Arnold's horse fell under him, and he himself was wounded. He cried out,
"Rush on, my brave boys!"
Nightfall now put an end to this day's bloody contest.
Ouch! Arnold was hurt for the third time. What's going on with the British? What are they thinking and feeling?
Brigadier General Fraser was mortally wounded, which helped to turn the fate of the day. When General Burgoyne saw him fall, he seemed then to feel in the highest degree our disagreeable situation.
Fraser, seriously wounded but still alive, was brought to the place where the Baroness was staying.
About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, in place of the guests who were to have dined with me, they brought in to me upon a litter poor General Fraser, mortally wounded. Our dining table, which was already spread, was taken away, and in its place they fixed up a bed for the general. I sat in a corner of the room, trembling and quaking. The noises grew continually louder. The thought that they might bring in my husband in the same manner was to me dreadful and tormented me incessantly. The general said to the surgeon, "Do not conceal anything from me. Must I die?" The ball had gone through his intestines. I heard him often, amidst his groans, exclaim, "Oh, fatal ambition! Poor General Burgoyne, my poor wife!" Prayers were read to him. He then sent a message to General Burgoyne, begging that he would have him buried the following day at 6 o'clock in the evening on top of a hill. Finally, toward evening, I saw my husband coming, upon which I forgot all my sufferings and thanked God that he had spared him to me. He drew me one side and told me that everything might go very badly and that I must keep myself in constant readiness for departure.
Things were pretty grim for Burgoyne, and the next morning the rebels continued their offensive.
About 8 in the morning, we perceived the enemy marching from their camp in great numbers, blackening the fields with their dark clothing. From the height of the work and by the help of our glasses, we could distinguish them quite plain. Our design was to amuse them during the day with our cannon, which kept them at a proper distance, and at night to make our retreat. But they soon guessed our intentions and sent a large body of troops in our rear to push for the possession of the heights of Fort Edward.
Fraser died early in the morning. Burgoyne granted him his dying wish by allowing him to be buried on the battlefield in a ceremony the evening of October 8th.
At sunset, General Fraser was buried according to his desire, and General Burgoyne attended the service, which was performed, I think, in the most solemn manner I ever before saw. Perhaps the scene around, big with the fate of many, caused it to appear more so, with their firing particularly at our battery during the time of its continuance.
Oh, jeez, I can't imagine what that's like. The generals and officers standing on a hilltop as explosions of cannon fire fell all around them. Was the Baroness up there?
She was close by.
The cannonballs flew continually around and over the party. The American general, Gates, afterwards said that if he had known that it was a burial, he would not have allowed any firing in that direction. Many cannonballs also flew not far from me, but I had my eyes fixed upon the hill where I distinctly saw my husband in the midst of the enemy's fire, and therefore I could not think of my own danger.
Insult to injury, the weather was terrible. A constant and heavy rain fell on this cold autumn evening, contributing to a miserable situation. Digby said it was impossible to sleep because of the cold and the rain. As darkness fell over Saratoga, Burgoyne planned his retreat.
Grandpa, now I've got a picture of the whole gruesome thing. I want to see the battlefield.
I think it's time for us to go. Hey, let's check out the visitor center here at the Saratoga battlefield, explore the exhibits, maybe even take a drive on the Tor Road.